This week, it's the cornerback show. We're looking at why so many rookies and second-year players are thriving, why you don't see aging star corners moving to safety these days, the future of Richard Sherman, and our ranking of the top 10 cornerbacks in football, settling that three-way race between Peterson, Ramsey, and Rhodes. It's all on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We have reached the penultimate episode of our position rankings series. This week it is cornerbacks. Next week it is quarterbacks. That seems unintentionally confusing, but we are talking about cornerbacks this week. Really talent-rich position at this point. Really young and talent-rich position, Andy.
And to paint a picture of the significance of the position, when I first went to NFL Films as a student, I went to Greg Cosell's office, and he was going to tutor me for an entire week, and it was a wonderful week, and it was back in 2011. So the Steelers had just played the Packers in the Super Bowl, and the very first thing we watched, the first thing Cosell said is, let's start right up here and take a look at Ike Taylor, their cornerback. And he was a free agent at that point. He said it was a lockout, so we didn't know where he was going. But he said, someone's going to soon pay Ike Taylor a whole lot of money, because see how he is one-on-one on an island here? All these coverages, and coverages are the first thing you need to learn if you're learning football. All these coverages you're about to see from the Steelers come from Ike Taylor going one-on-one right here. And there are not a lot of guys in the league that can do that, but theoretically, that's what every defense is trying to find and achieve. That's what you need if you want to be an ultimate schematic defense.
Well, let's start with some of the guys who are kind of growing into that role and sort of talk about where we're headed as a whole with the position. Last year we had Jalen Ramsey, I think sort of a undisputed superstar at this point in year two. We had Marshawn Lattimore, Tre'Davious White, Adoree Jackson, really great players as rookies. William Jackson was not technically a rookie, but he missed all of 2016, and then he ended up being a star last year. Why is this a position that seems to be skewing not only so much toward young guys, but why are young guys so able to come in and have this kind of immediate impact?
I think there's a couple of reasons, and one is cornerback takes more athleticism than any position on the field. You're running more, you're running backwards a lot of the time. It's a reactionary position. You have to mirror wide receivers, who are usually the best athletes on the offense. So most of these guys are just immensely talented. That's why so many corners are first and second round picks. So you have talent, and the talent's coming to fruition. And I think more so now than a few years ago, defenses play matchup coverages. Even the Jaguars, who are a classic zone defense in a lot of ways, the one way they're not is on the perimeter. They play basically man-to-man outside and then zone up the middle. So that's why they went out and got A.J. Bouye, who's going to be on our top 10 list, of course, and Jalen Ramsey, who's going to be very high on our top 10 list. Teams, even the zone coverage teams, the Bills are similar as well, and they did that with Tre'Davious White. Even the zone coverage teams are playing more matchup concepts on the perimeter. Cover three zone, which is the most common coverage you see. It's a basic coverage. It's probably half the snaps in the NFL are cover three. Most of the time, the cornerbacks in that scheme are essentially playing a different style of man-to-man technique. So cover corners, they'll always be valuable for that reason.
And, I mean, why are these guys, we talk about the rookie curve and late in the season, the rookie wall and stuff like that. I mean, is it just a matter of, you don't have the wear and tear on your body? Obviously it's a position that involves a lot of reaction, a lot of, you have to be a fluid mover, you have to be able to change directions quickly. I mean, does that just lend itself to, the guys in their early and mid-20s?
It does, and it's also a position that's mentally it's easier to transition to. I remember another time I was at NFL Films, and Matt Millen stopped by, and somebody made the comment about we were watching. It was actually a Lions corner we were watching, so it was someone Millen had drafted. Millen had just been fired at this time, and someone's made the comment like, well, I don't know if he's a very smart player. And Millen said, oh, no, he's dumb as a rock. But here's the beauty of it all. When a cornerback's dumb as a rock, you just say, hey, dumb guy, you got that wide receiver right over there. Run with him. You can scheme around cornerbacks a little bit because of the matchup element, the basis of football. Even you and I, Gary, when we grew up playing it in the schoolyard, it's I got him, you got him. Mm-hmm. Everything's man-to-man. Every sport's man-to-man when you're a kid. That can be true for young corners. And these guys we're talking about, and I'm not saying any of these guys are – I don't know Marshon Lattimore's football IQ. I don't know William Jackson's. I would imagine it's still pretty high. But in areas where it might not be so comfortable for them, Tre'Davious White, Adoree' Jackson, all of these guys thrived on matchup coverages last year, and especially Ramsey. And matchup coverages look the same in the NFL as they do, for the most part, as they do when you're in college or when you're in high school. What gets tricky is when you get into the Patriots and these teams that do these switch releases and crossing routes, mm-hmm. and all the stuff that confuses man coverage. But we're talking right now about perimeter cornerback play only.
And you had mentioned a minute ago, zone schemes, cover three zone schemes, and that doesn't really apply to the guys on the outside. I mean, are there any teams left in 2018 that play what you'd consider a pure zone, or is there, who sort of skews toward the purest zone defense?
Well, the short answer to that question is Tampa Bay. It's and I think it's pretty clear it's Tampa Bay, but. There's a big difference between cover three and cover two zone if we're talking cornerbacks, because in cover three, you're still a zone defender. You're responsible for any outside receiver, or at least the widest outside receiver.
Yeah.
You're responsible to run with him as deep or as far downfield as he goes. But that doesn't mean you're not still playing zone. You have other responsibilities within that, because if that receiver does not run deep downfield, now what are your responsibilities? So think of it this way. In man-to-man, you play to the help of the sideline. In cover three, you're still playing your man, but you're often playing to the help of the defenders inside of you. Whatever the nearest help is, the sideline or the defenders inside of you, that's what you play to for the most part. Now, Jacksonville and what Seattle started doing with Richard Sherman and why mm-hmm. they're unique is they'll go a little more aggressively towards that man-to-man side, and they'll just say, you treat it like man and don't worry about the help inside. But those guys that are so good, and the guys that when they get these interceptions, Sherman and Ramsey at the top of their routes, it's often when they're playing to the help of the defenders inside, because that's when they can see the ball and play back to it. So Tampa, I say they're the obvious zone team, because cover two is when you have a safety over the top of the corner. So now you don't have to run deep with your widest outside receiver. So now you truly are playing zone. You're just playing in an underneath flat area. And the Buccaneers, I haven't charted this, but I would be surprised if it's different. The Buccaneers played cover two or similar concepts more than any defense in the league last year. And to be honest, I thought there were times where they were very predictable. And you think, well, why would they ever do that? But then you go back, remember in the second half of 2016, they were doing that, and they were one of the best defenses in the NFL over those last 2 months.
I mean, once you start doing that, now you're just relying on a pass rush, which, as we've covered on the show quite a few times, the Buccaneers did not have last year.
Exactly. It's a great point. That's exactly right. Zone, and that's true of all zone coverage for anyone at any position. Zone coverage is not designed to last for more than 2.5, maybe 3 seconds. So you are dependent on your pass rush if you're playing zone. Man-to-man, theoretically, it's hard to hold your man-to-man coverage longer than 3 seconds, but because you have a greater chance of impeding the receiver early in the route, because you're using your hands, you're physical, you're up on him, most of these man-to-man guys are anyway, they can go a little, it's not as time sensitive, it can go a little bit longer. So zone coverages are always dependent on the pass rush, because zones inherently get widened and distorted the longer the play goes along.
Let's move inside. The slot corners, the nickel corner, I guess you would call it for shorthand. The pure slot guys, thinking Aaron Colvin got a decent deal this offseason, but we still see a lot of guys around the league just don't get paid. It's not a valued position, or it seems like it's an undervalued position at this point. I mean, why is that? It seems like it would be a more difficult position to play just because you know, the receiver coming off the line has a two-way go. A lot of times he's back off the line of scrimmage, so you can't really press him as effectively. Is it just a matter of the fact that teams really don't throw deep in the middle of the field, and therefore you sort of don't have that that risk of getting burned?
It might be that when teams do throw deep in the middle of the field, it's usually against a linebacker or safety, because that's what the play was designed to exploit. The only way you get two corners inside is if you have four wide receivers on the field typically. So it could be some of that. It's interesting, Gary. First of all, let me ask you something kind of personal. Do you think I reference my All-Pro voting too much on these shows?
I don't.
I worry that I humble bragging. That's what I'm worried I do. But it's these top 10 players, so it keeps coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of conversations we've had off the, off the podcast. No, I don't think I've heard about it too much.
Well, so I'm going to reference it again. When I sat down last year to do, thank you. When I did my top, my All-Pro for the slot corner position last year, and I went through all the nominees, what I realized, and I don't think I'd noticed it before, there aren't very many good ones in the NFL. There are not a lot of good slot corners out there. The only guys I even considered were Chris Harris, Logan Ryan, Patrick Robinson for the Eagles. He's now a Saint. And then Mike Hilton had a very surprisingly nice year in Pittsburgh. And and Colvin for Jacksonville, who's now in Houston. And by the way, I think he's going to play outside a lot more than in the slot, I've heard. We'll see how that goes. But I was surprised at the dearth of slot corner talent in the NFL, because a lot of teams now are building their system around attacking at least in the slot area. May not be always with the slot receiver, but attacking between the field numbers, that's where the route combinations take place. And slot corners have, you're right, they have the hardest job in football. Not only is it hard to play man-to-man when the receiver has a two-way go, but when you're playing zone coverage and all these different types of zones, you have defender help on both sides of you, and that you have to account for that. So you have more to process and think about, and it might seem easier because you got help on both sides, but you have to play to that help, and that help's expecting you to play to it in a certain way. So if you're wrong, you're going to make somebody else wrong as well, and that's the difference between man and zone coverage breakdowns. I'm with you. I don't know why more teams aren't prioritizing slot corners if there are just not very many good ones out there. The Eagles, I've heard, with Sidney Jones this year, who obviously they feel he's going to be a number one corner for them someday, and we have no idea if that'll pan out or not, but he's getting reps in the slot because they have to fill the void left by Robinson, and it's either Jones or Jalen Mills did that a few years ago. But that's an interesting concept, because Jones was an outside corner primarily at Washington, and that's how many believes he transfers to the NFL. So they're basically cross-training him to play the slot. I would think more teams would want to do that with young corners because of just the vet. Look at what Chris Harris does for Denver and how valuable his versatility is.
Yeah, I mean, would you do that with a guy who maybe you're thinking a year or two down the line, this is a guy who's going to travel with number ones? And, sort of along those lines, how many guys left do travel with number ones still?
It's probably about half the corners in half the teams in the league have a true traveling number one corner, maybe a little less than half. Mm-hmm. But it's some of them like Carolina with James Bradbury, for example. James Bradbury is not going to be he's a nice young player, but he's not going to be in our top 10 list here. But Carolina is not particularly rich at cornerback around Bradbury, so that's partly why he travels. If they ever had Darius Slay, another guy who travels, if he came in and played opposite Bradbury, they might not travel those guys. So some of it's the function of your other personnel. Some of it is body type size. Xavier Rhodes travels with number one receivers, but early in his career, he would only travel with big receivers because he's a big corner. He's gotten better. He now travels with the small guys like Antonio Brown, who Rhodes kicked his butt last year when they played in week two. But Xavier Rhodes is on our list. There aren't a lot of guys like that. Yeah. And Rhodes rarely travels into the slot. Now, the reason for that, though, is when you get into who should travel to the slot or not, what kind of scheme do you run? Because we just said the difference between man coverage in the slot and zone is striking. And certain teams like Patrick Peterson in Arizona, he'll travel into the slot if it's man-to-man, but they would never ask him to play zone in the slot. They think he'd probably be a below-average player overall if he had to do that. So can you – it gets back to Chris Harris, who I hope makes our list here, because he can play man and zone in the slot. So can Desmond Trufant. Those are really the only two elite corners off the top of my head I can think of who are do-everything guys, whether they're aligned outside or inside. So it's hard to travel because it's just too much to ask. Can you play man or zone outside? Can you do it inside? They're two drastically different jobs.
Let's talk about Richard Sherman here. I don't have a great transition for that, but I'm just going to say let's talk about Richard Sherman because he is going to be a fascinating guy this year. He's coming off the ruptured Achilles. Obviously, he's not a young man anymore. He was such a fascinating player in Seattle. And look, again, we don't put too much emphasis on what guys are personality-wise or off the field because nobody really knows him that well. He's a guy who the NFL is better when he's playing really well, I think. In San Francisco, realistically, what's your gut feeling? Obviously, a lot of this has to do with the medical, and we just don't know that. We're not going to see that until September. But what's your gut feeling on what he's going to be this year?
My gut feeling is it's a lot of medical to overcome. He had surgery on both Achilles, and when you injure one, supposedly the other one becomes at risk because of how you have to compensate in the way you walk or whatever you do with your Achilles. So I'm not optimistic. I'm hopeful for Sherman. Personally, I don't know him at all. I met him one time. I'm not Robert Klemko, where I know him extremely well and hang out with him and talk about going to Mexico. I don't know if they've ever done that, but I've... The people I know, they like him personally, so I hope everything goes well for him. I thought he was slowing down a few years ago, and he made me look kind of foolish. He played very well when he was healthy, but he has not in the past played super well when he's been unhealthy, at least not by his lofty standards. Let me ask you this, Gary, and he's going to be in the same scheme in San Fran that he was in Seattle, and I'm sure that's partly why he signed there. Yeah, that absolutely helps. Let me ask you this. If his career ended today, is he a Hall of Famer?
Gosh. Yeah. I'm putting like all those Seahawks guys in the Hall of Fame, though. Byron Maxwell, too. I'm putting them all in there.
Yeah, you want for the longest time, I thought Maxwell was on that track. I loved Byron Maxwell. He was so long and equipped for that scheme. And then, quite frankly, when he got paid, he wasn't the same player.
Yeah. No, Byron Maxwell was a good player back in the day. He's not so much anymore. But Richard Sherman Hall of Fame, I always lean towards yes. I always prefer the guys who were special players, even if it was a relatively abbreviated time, as opposed to guys who were maybe very good over a longer period of time. So we're talking at this point basically seven seasons.
Yep. Oh. Fifth round pick in 2011. I remember when he first came in, the guy, he first played against was A.J. Green. I remember Richard Sherman came off the bench and spent the entire game. First of all, he dominated A.J. Green. I think he even had an interception in the game. But he spent all the rest of the game when he wasn't dominating him right up in Green's grill, just belittling him. And I actually asked A.J. Green's coach, hey, what was that about? And they said they were perplexed on the sideline. Like, well, who is this guy and what's his beef with A.J. Green? They thought it was something that dated back to like the rookie symposium.
Yeah.
Sherman felt slighted, like maybe a cut in line at the water fountain by accident. I don't know what it was. You know how these guys go. But I wrote an article the next day for the New York Times about this new trash-talking corner bursting on the scene. And the whole article referred to this guy, Roger Sherman, for the Seattle Seahawks. He was very new and unheard of at the time, but he was great the second he stepped onto the field.
His backstory is outstanding. Obviously, he's a unique guy. He's a unique player.
First team All-Pro 2012-14, 3 years in a row. Second team in 2015.
Yep.
So probably that's probably as good of a 4-year run as any corner has ever had, in, at least in the, this, our lifetime era here, other than maybe Deion Sanders.
Yeah.
And well, Darrell Revis. Yeah, Darrell other Revis. Than Revis, too, yeah. But nobody debates their Hall of Famer. Sanders is in, and Revis is obviously a Hall of Famer whenever he's eligible. Yeah, I would go on Sherman. I don't love the Terrell Davis thing where great for a little while you get in, but I think Sherman was great for more than a little while.
Well, and you just kind of look back, how many cornerbacks were sort of the guy who almost like defined what their team was, and not only their team, but a great team, a team that obviously won a Super Bowl and was one play away from winning a second one. So, I lean yes. I hope he has a good year or two in San Francisco, and then that will sort of put the debate to bed. But if he washes out this year, yeah, that'll be an interesting one.
Let me ask this one. Do you think Richard Sherman, who I'm sure listens and subscribes to this podcast like every NFL player, do you think he'd be happy or annoyed by this past 3 minutes of conversation we've had? We're basically talking about him in the past tense.
Yes, I would guess he'd be very annoyed because I think he's probably a guy who sees himself as a guy who will play for another 5 years, which he might. I hope he does. I'll ask a part two to this question, to the Sherman discussion. This has been sort of something of a misconception over the years. I think people got a little bit carried away with the Charles Woodson thing late in his career. But, there always are these conversations about how, aging corner, well, move him to safety. How does Sherman, because in theory, it seems like he has the tools to play safety if he has lost half a step. He's certainly going to help you in run support. He's big. He's cerebral. His ability to play in space, Andy. Is this a guy who potentially translates to that position?
No, I don't see him that way. Woodson was a swivelly, sinewy player. He was very pliable and flexible. Sherman's not. Sherman's a stiffer mover. That's just the way he's athletically constructed. Woodson was fast when he was young, so there was an element of speed to that smooth movement. Sherman has never been fast. He's been strong, he's been extremely smart, and his ball skills are off the charts, and that's why he's been great. And that's why he's great when he's near the sideline, when you play to the sideline help. Mm-hmm. When you put Sherman in space, he's a different player completely. I would imagine he's very rarely been in space. There's always a reason you don't see guys do things. I don't ever envision safety for Richard Sherman. He'd have to be a strong safety, and he's not close to big enough. He's a little bit under 200 pounds.
Mm.
Why do you think the Woodson thing got overblown? Is it because you've heard Peter King tell the story 10,000 times about how Rodney Harrison casually in the green room at NBC once said Woodson's the greatest defensive back of all time?
I had never heard that.
Heard that story?
That was never relayed to me, or perhaps it was relayed to me and I just wasn't paying attention. But I just think back to Woodson because I feel like he is the last guy who was great at cornerback and then moved to safety and was great at safety. And we had this conversation, I shouldn't say we, a lot of people had this conversation about Darrell Revis 2 years ago. Do you move Revis to safety? And I think overall, the sort of the litmus test, the 2 seconds to think about it thing is, well, was he physical enough? And you say yes or no, and that's what you decide. But I feel like it's something that came up so much with Revis. Am I forgetting someone? Has anyone else made that switch in the last five years?
Not that you would think it would happen more than it does, and it doesn't happen. Not only does it not happen, we don't hear about it happening very much. It seems like one of those things where every April or May we'd have 5 or 6 corners that might move to safety, and it just doesn't go that way, which tells you they're two very different positions. Yeah, tackling and not tackling, that's a little bit of it, although corners still have to tackle too, and Sherman's always been tremendous at that, by the way. But I think they're very different positions. It just doesn't appear that way on the surface. Some of the guys, Aeneas Williams and Rod Woodson, they did it as well. But we're talking first ballot Hall of Fame or close to first ballot Hall, and certainly Hall of Fame. Remember, we saw Aeneas Williams in the hot dog line at the Super Bowl in his gold jacket. These are Hall of Fame guys that are doing it successfully.
Oh, man. I hot dog line, huh?
Remember that? I told you, I said walking around at in Minnesota, he was in line at the hot dog stand in his Hall of Fame gold jacket.
Was it a hot dog stand specifically? Because that would make me happy.
Yes, yes. It was a concession stand, so you could get popcorn and those other things. But he was getting a hot dog, people were getting a hot dog. It was a hot dog, but with a supporting cast. It wasn't those hot dog carts you have in New York that get wheeled around on the street corners.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I'm glad about that. Let's transition to the top 10 cornerbacks for 2018. But first, a quick programming note. And by the way, we're going to be heavy in programming notes coming the next couple of weeks. We have some changes coming up, but we'll have to finalize those first and tell you about them later. We have a mailbag show coming up in 2 weeks. We're going to do the quarterbacks next week. That will be the last of the position ranking series. Then we'll have a mailbag show. You can ask questions about the position rankings. You can write manifestos about things you disagreed with during the position ranking series. Or you can just ask stuff, maybe about the upcoming season here. You can ask anything. I like the dumb questions, the hypothetical, can you have a 600-pound tailback and stuff like that. But send your questions. That's really the point here. You can send them to talkback@themmqb.com. That is, please put podcast in the subject line so it is easier to find. You can tweet at us, Andy_Benoit, ggramling_si, or you can get us on Facebook. You will have to learn how to spell our names and type them into the search feature. Should be able to get us there. But that'll do it for that. Let's get to the top 10 cornerbacks. Cornerbacks. Yeah. Since I sort of mumbled that last part.
Have you ever had when you explain football to someone who knows nothing, like your grandmother or something? Do you find yourself treading lightly when you say cornerback because you think they're going to think quarterback every time, and now this whole conversation blows up?
Yes, you have to really emphasize the corner. I never talk football with either of my grandparents, either of my grandmothers, or my grandfather used to love Jay Fiedler. That was the extent of our football conversations.
The quarterback.
Yeah, down in Miami. They were in a retirement community down in Boca Raton.
Oh.
And Jay Fiedler, he was he was a Jewish gentleman. They lived in a community that was very heavy in the Jewish community, and they all loved Jay Fiedler down there. I think the Jay Fiedler love was very localized to certain areas like that down in Miami. But they were big Jay Fiedler fans. My grandfather especially would talk a lot about Jay Fiedler. Not that
well,
much.
I don't talk football with grandparents either, but sometimes if they ask, where did you go on a trip, and you say, I met with a cornerback, you have to say cornerback and then explain what that is, and then the whole story loses luster because what they hear is not quarterback.
Defensive back.
Well, they need to know that he's not a safety. I mean, we just had that conversation. That's a big differential. I don't want my 92-year-old grandmother thinking a guy who's a corner can play safety when we know he can't.
Embarrassing herself. the top 10 cornerbacks in football. If you are listening to the first time, the way we do this, it is AP poll style. We have three voters. That is Andy, myself, and Joe Rowles, who helped us out with research this week. AP poll style. We each ranked our top 15. If you got a first-place vote, that's 15 points. Second-place vote, 14 points, down to 15th-place vote, 1 point. Andy's votes count double because we like him that much. But let's first unveil the others receiving votes. We had 20, and even 20. Very, very nice, very symmetrical. Let's start with Darius Slay William Jackson, Aqib Talib, Trumaine Johnson, Stephon Gilmore, Janoris Jenkins, Adoree Jackson, Josh Norman, Jimmy Smith, and Kendall Fuller. I think William Jackson might be a guy knocking on the door of top five by the end of this season. But I did want to bring up two names here, two veterans, actually. Stephon Gilmore, I mean, he was such a punching bag the first, let's say, 4 or 5 weeks of last season in New England, getting the big contract. And they were kind of a mess on the back end early on. They gave up a lot of big plays. It seemed to be a communication issue there. I thought he was really good down the stretch. And on top of that, you know, he really didn't give up much of anything in the Super Bowl. And he made a big play to get them to the Super Bowl in the AFC title game.
I concur with all of that from beginning to end. He got better, as that whole Patriots secondary did. They simplified things to correct those communication breakdowns. What teams were doing was getting into – they're doing what the Patriots do to the other teams. They were getting into bunch and stack formations. They were motioning to it, so they showed one formation, motioned to a different formation, and then these guys crisscrossed, these receivers, they crisscrossed off the line, and none of the Patriots could figure out who had who. So New England simplified everything. Gilmore, about as far as who has who and their rules there, they simplified it. Gilmore played very well after they simplified it, but the catchy part is, and this is not a critique of Gilmore, it's just what happened, is in that simplification, that defense became easier to figure out, and mm-hmm. Philadelphia killed them for it in the Super Bowl. That's how the Eagles put up all those points, is they knew exactly how the Patriots would handle bunch and switch releases. So that's the game of football, folks, is adjustments on top of adjustments and who can handle it.
Do you expect them to be able to do more this year, or is that just are they playing with fire with Gilmore again? And I realize that the Patriots also have kind of a luxury in that I feel like they have a little more leeway during the regular season to tinker with some things. I mean, everyone tinkers to an extent, but the Patriots, if they drop a game in September, the sky's not going to be falling.
No, well, unless it's week one against the Chiefs, and the sky's already fallen and everybody's dead. But other than that, they're fine. It's Tom Brady camouflages a lot of this. The Patriots can win 35-30 if they have to on certain weeks. So, yeah, they do have the freedom to tinker with this stuff. They better be stronger in this area this year because they're paying Stephon Gilmore all that money. They wouldn't pay him all that if they didn't think they could expand their coverages with his presence.
Do you think there's buyer's remorse there right now, or is it too early to say that?
I don't think there is because of those improvements you alluded to down the stretch last season.
Okay.
And I think my, from what I can gather, and people around the league are the ones who know are very tight-lipped about this, as you would imagine, but I think Belichick's just so happy to be rid of Malcolm Butler that he's going to be fine with having Gilmore as the true number one core. I think that, my guess is they would blame not Gilmore for some of the stuff that happened last year. And I'm not saying that's fair either, by the way.
Well, let's. There's one other guy I wanted to talk about, and that is Josh Norman. And I'll ask quite literally the same question, which is buyer's remorse in Washington, just because of what they're paying him. We had talked about this from Carolina's end when they originally rescinded the franchise tag and let Norman go, and how even if you thought Norman was going to play at an elite level, it just didn't make a ton of sense for Carolina to give a monster contract to a cornerback, considering the scheme they run. It was still Sean McDermott back then. But Washington scooped him up. It's been 2 years. It's been an interesting 2 years. If you're Washington, are you looking back and saying, maybe that money could have been better spent elsewhere?
Well, you might be now because you haven't won anything in those 2 years, and that's when Norman's gotten all the money. He'll cost mm-hmm. $6 million in dead cap if they cut him next year. This year, it's $22.5 million of dead cap, so there's no decision there. He had to be on the roster. I think he's played fine. He hasn't been special or amazing, but Washington runs a very similar scheme to Carolina. They might be the answer to who's the most zone-based defense in the NFL. At least at well, let me just put it this way. When they go zone, they really go zone. They're very straightforward zone coverage. And Norman has been up and down overall. Remember, though, Gary, it's not just these guys and Norman, and they actually don't travel him a whole lot, which has been a controversy, mm-hmm. especially remember early in his first year there, everyone was saying, why is he not shadowing Antonio Brown, who killed him in week one in 2016? And they didn't, Bryant.
He was saying that too in the lead up to that first season.
Well, and there's I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And I think he probably should have been, to be completely honest. But he wasn't. But most of these guys, and at times he has traveled. And a lot of these guys are talking about, they're facing the top receivers in the NFL. They're going to give up some catches. Antonio Brown's going to get 100 yards on just about anyone he faces. Mike Evans is going to have some big plays here. And it's hard jobs to handle. So you're inherently set up to fail in that sense. But your ability to take those jobs and at least survive them or tread water with them, that allows everyone else around you to play differently, to do their jobs, to not get overwhelmed. So it's still number one corners. You can't just look at how many catches they're giving up and how that all that goes. You have to look at what they're being asked to do.
All right. So what's your answer, Andy? Regrettable
signing? If
they
have buyer's remorse or not?
Yeah.
Well, sure, yes, if it's hindsight, because, again, they haven't won anything, and he's been the cornerstone of their defense. So you could say, bottom line, it hasn't worked. I think that's oversimplifying it, but it's an oversimplified question.
All right. Well, now you're coming after me. Top 10. Let's start rolling this out. Number 10, that is Tre'Davious White. Number 9, Desmond Trufant. Number 8, Marshawn Lattimore. So, as we said, young man's position right now, and two rookies right there. Lattimore was such a difference maker in that Saints defense, and on top of that, you need that corner in the NFC South with the guys you have to face. I mean, he's got to get Mike Evans twice a year, and he's certainly gotten under Mike Evans' skin. And, you got to get Julio twice a year down there.
Yep, it's a big deal. And Dennis Allen, their defensive coordinator, he wants to diversify his scheme and disguise coverages and blitz. And the way you can do that is to have a number one corner on an island, because that frees up your safeties and your linebackers, all your other defenders. They now don't have to help against a certain receiver, so they're free to do whatever. If they do have to help against a certain receiver, then as a defense, you have to react to the formation. You have to, the offense's formation. You have to wait and see where that receiver lines up and then set your coverage. So it's almost impossible to build in coverage disguises, because you don't even know what coverage you're starting in until everybody lines up. If you don't have to help against the receiver, if you just say Lattimore, you follow Evans, then you can now be thinking about your disguises, and you're not not the prisoner to the formation that you would have been.
Number 7, Marcus Peters. Number 6, Casey Hayward. Number 5, Chris Harris. Number 4, A.J. Bouye. A number 2 corner. Number 4. Marcus Peters. Let's talk about Marcus Peters really quick. The Chiefs moved on because of stuff that was not necessarily happening on Sundays.
That shoe temper tantrum took place on a Sunday.
Well, the shoe temper tantrum also took place on a Sunday. The people on our staff who reported it, they got, this is stuff that was on deep background, but there was, it went well beyond the shoe tantrum thing. He just wasn't working out there, and obviously we'll see how it goes with the Rams. But on the field, how does it go with the Rams? I mean, we have a couple of guys who, and he and Talib were sort of ball hawking type of corners for this defense.
Absolutely. Those are guys that I could see, not Talib as much, but Peters stylistically might be the kind that moves well to safety, because he's an off coverage corner. Remember Asante Samuel years ago, and he actually moved to safety late in his career. Didn't go well, but the transition took place. Peters is similar to Asante Samuel. They're off coverage cover corners that read your routes and read the quarterback's drop, and they make plays on the ball, versus being physical press man corners that that tried to disrupt the receiver's timing. So Peters will always get a lot of interceptions, and they'll always give up some big plays here and there because that's his style of play. Versus Patrick Peterson, who, spoiler, is number 3 on our list. I'm taking your job here, Gary. He doesn't get a lot of interceptions. Yeah, I know.
There was some drama coming up.
You're annoyed, aren't you? Yeah, you're right. I screwed that up. I screwed you. But he's not a big interceptor because he has his hands on guys. He has his eye on the receiver, so he's not looking at the ball. He's not as free to make a play on the ball. So Marcus Peters, I think he'll transition fine to the Rams as long as the pass rush is there. When the pass rush doesn't get there, those off-coverage corners become liability sometimes. Same with Talib. Both of those guys. It's an interesting combination. I don't think I've seen a pair of corners so stylistically aggressive as what the Rams have acquired this offseason.
And should mention, you would think that corners, because of the stuff we talked about at the top, how it's the most athletically demanding position, and it's sort of the position that you would think you could almost, obviously you can't do this 100%, but if you look at the combine numbers, you can get a pretty good idea of who's going to be able to play and who's not going to be able to play. And I think this is also teams that use the analytics of what they get at the combine. This is one that plays a big role, how the cornerbacks test. But AJ Bouye, our number 4 guy, and Chris Harris, our number 5, both undrafted. It's kind of bizarre that they would sort of slip through the cracks like this.
It is. They play with technique. They're very honed. They're well refined, and that's what's gotten them so much success. Have you noticed, before I used to humble brag about the all-pro voting process, I would humble brag about having played against Chris Harris, which I did a few years ago. Those stories stopped, and you want to know why? You want whose fault it is?
Is it my fault?
You have to say, you've been very supportive of my career. You edited the Chris Harris story, and you liked it, and you bring it up for me every now and then because I'm still proud that I got to play against him. 18 routes, one catch on 18 routes, but I occupied the best corner on the field that day too. So everyone else around me, which was nobody actually, was. But I used to brag to almost every coach I'd sit down with a few years ago. I worked it in the car, like, hey, how's it going with you? Hey, did you hear I played against Chris Harris? I would be so excited. And Jeff Imamura, the Panthers DB coach, he watched the Harris tape and he said, no, Chris did not give 20%. He was playing much. He was giving 50% against you. And Imamura explained why. He said he's doing that drop kick or that step kick technique that we teach there. And so I was very proud. Oh, 50%. Oh, so he was playing harder. But then I had lunch with John DeFilippo. Now he's the coordinator of the Vikings offense. And I told him, and he said to me in response, he said, and the really painful part of this was how casual he was about it. We're sitting at the bar. He's got his elbow up on the bar. He's drinking his water. It's lunchtime. And he doesn't even look over at me. He just keeps looking straight ahead. And he said, no offense, but if Chris didn't want you to move, you wouldn't have moved out there. And ever since he said that, I haven't told the story to anyone because there goes the balloon. Burst.
It's still a very good story. It's still one of my favorite stories that that we've done at the MMQB. I will say that. And if you haven't, what was that? I should know the headline of the story at this point.
I think it was me against Chris Harris, wasn't it? Like the word me? No, it's like I think it was a journalist takes on Chris Harris or something.
I wouldn't put journalist in there.
I remember someone did, and I remember thinking, why do they call me a journalist? I'm not a journalist. I don't have that kind of integrity. I'm just a guy that writes football.
You're right. Me versus Chris Harris. Fantastic.
And then the subheading has journalist, doesn't it?
Oh, I don't know. Our subheads disappeared when we migrated from the old site, so I don't remember what my what my subhead was, but like the SEO, boy, we're really getting into the weeds here. The thing that pops up if you Google it, that has journalist in it, because that's just supposed to be a generic description of what the story was. But
I haven't looked at it a whole lot. The other thing is my legs in that video, I wore shorts, it's a hot day.
Yep.
They were very pasty and ill-defined. That wasn't something I realized about myself until I saw that.
Oh, man. That's why I don't let anyone look at me ever. No photographs of me can be found.
You want to reveal our big top three here? Yeah.
Top three. Well, look, I mean, this was kind of up in the air. I think this was one of the positions where you didn't have an obvious number one, even though there's so many great players. So as Andy spoiled a few minutes ago, Patrick Peterson is our number three. He's a guy who's been number one the last couple years. Number two, Xavier Rhodes, which means number one, Jalen Ramsey. And I mean, look, I don't, whatever, those guys are 1A, 1B, and 1C as far as I'm concerned.
I had Rhodes ahead of Ramsey, but I'm not gonna put up a fight about that conversation. They're all great, and you know what's the at least those top two guys. The common factor is they are long bodied guys. AJ Bouye a little bit too, and Peterson's not a stout guy either. He's kind of long. That helps a lot. Length is a big deal, especially for a corner.
Yeah, I mean that. Look, this obviously Seattle goes to an extreme with it, but on the Seattle style corner, that was a big trend, and that's something that also fueled a lot of draft busts over the last couple of years. But you get that length on the outside, it's tough to drop a ball in over that.
And Seattle, I know Dan Quinn told me once, next to not ahead of length, actually. Length was not their top priority when scouting corners. He said the ability to track the ball was their top priority.
Yeah, that's a good point. Do you remember, I'm kind of going back, but whenever I think about basically cornerbacks and draft and all that, I always think back to, I want to say this was 2004, Ahmad Carroll was the Packers' first round pick. Yep, 2004.
Yeah. And late I just first remember, round, wasn't he? Late?
He was what? Let's see, pick 25. And he's actually, I mean, look, he's 34 years old. I mean, he could have still been playing, but I just remember he was one of those guys who if you look at the measurables, you'd think he could really play. He had he was 5'10", but he had the long arms, had the speed, had the quickness, all that, and he couldn't track the ball, and he could never adjust to not putting his hands all over receivers like he can in the college game a little bit, and just a million flags. I just remember him getting flagged constantly.
That's a delicate balance. Ike Taylor's the same kind. Ike Taylor has no ball skills whatsoever, and he was extremely physical, and he learned to get away with it. And that's why he never became Ahmad Carroll. Taylor was a third-round pick as well. But that's the hard part for the we should have talked about that earlier, is the transitioning and the amount of physicality you're allowed to apply in the NFL versus college. Mm-hmm. That is an adjustment for guys. And the other part of that, and why it's so impressive that these rookies played so well last year, the Lattimores, the Whites, the Adoree Jackson, who we should have talked about him too. I think he's going to be a big player. But is you can't practice bump-and-run coverage in these OTAs very much. The rules are, it's a contact, no contact's the rule. NFLPA worked for that, and it means no bump and run coverage. So it's hard for a corner to get ready to play in the NFL because he can't take meaningful NFL reps until July.
That's the Ravens got popped for that this offseason. That was bump and run coverage was their violation, right?
Yeah, and if I were the Ravens, I'd say well worth it, because I think we lost 2 days of practice. Most teams give up the last day anyway, which I've never understood, but they like to do it for morale boosting, let's all go to the water park instead of practice kind of thing. I would give up, so they gave up one practice. I'd sacrifice one practice if I could get away with bump and run coverage in my other practices.
And by the way, Dee Milliner, another guy who always comes to mind,
yes.
A guy who couldn't adjust to the to the demand for less physicality in the NFL as far as downfield.
We ought to have listeners send in, maybe it's not, we could do it ourselves, but top cornerback busts and see what the common trend is among all those guys.
Yeah, it's tough because it really should be the easiest position to identify.
Yeah, You think so? The one, yeah.
Not 100%, and not like, oh, it's such a no-brainer. How can you be great in college and not be great in the NFL type of thing? But I would think it's the easiest. I think it's the least, the smallest hill to climb as far as the cerebral parts of the game.
So it's the easiest position to play mentally.
Yeah, and I'd say it's also the you know, probably the most similar as far as schemes go from college to the NFL.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, I don't. That's yeah.
Because you're not worried about anything in the middle of the field. I mean, unless you're it's a different story if you're playing inside. But if you're playing the perimeter, you don't have to worry about all the stuff that goes on in the middle of the field that complicates things.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying it's easier, perhaps easiest.
Yeah, I hear you. You're getting a lukewarm agreement from me, which is the most I want to think about. You're going to hear from me in a few days on it, and you'll have forgotten all about it by then.
That's I'll take that. That's all I was going for. Let's go to the lightning-ish round. We're going to change this up a little bit this week, Andy. I don't know if you saw this on the outline. We're going to start with a trivia question. I'll ask it now, and then we will answer it at the end of the segment here. So you don't have to pause it if you're listening to your podcast. You can wait the 3 minutes or however long this lasts.
Lightning round.
Since Deion Sanders in 1994, how many cornerbacks have won Defensive Player of the Year honors, and who were they? As I said, answer at the end of the lightning round. Do you have any answers right off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, I think the answer is one. It's Darrelle Revis, because this has a little bit of a trick question element, is that Charles Woodson, when he won it, I believe he won it 1 year. Those guys were neck and neck 1 year, too, I remember. I think Woodson beat out Revis 1 year, and everybody kind of said, I don't know about that. But Woodson was a safety in those years. So my knee-jerk answer is just one corner, Darrelle Revis.
Okay, we'll get to that at the end of the lightning round. True or false, if Jason Verrett is healthy, the Chargers have a top trio of cornerbacks, whether you're calling it Hayward Verrett, Trevor Williams, or Hayward Verrett, Desmond King in football?
I would say false by a narrow margin. I'd still give that to the Tennessee Titans because I love how Adoree Jackson can travel with quicker lightning-type receivers. Logan Ryan can match up to the bigger ones, and both of those guys can play the slot. So there, and then Malcolm Butler's your number three. So, and I like Butler. I'm not in the Bill Belichick camp, although I would admit Belichick knows a little bit more about him than I do. I like that trio in Tennessee, though, because you get a little bit more schematic flexibility with the Chargers here. Out of those three, Trevor Williams, who's become a very nice player, Verrett and Hayward. Hayward's the only one with any true slot experience, which is why Desmond King actually might be the number three in that equation. So anyway, I'd take Titans. Who do you take?
I take Chargers. I was interested to see where you would put the Titans, though. I didn't know you were this high on Adoree Jackson. That sort of caught me off guard last night
either.
When we started to build this show.
I went back, and it's because I'm writing the Titans preview for the magazine here soon, mm-hmm. and I went back through all my Titans film notes, and so I'm fresher on Adoree Jackson, and I hadn't considered his rookie season from chapter A to B to C to D, the way you read the notes.
Yeah.
Once I took everything in whole, I thought he improved very well over the course of his rookie year.
Yeah, he was also a guy, I remember the draft last year, he was a guy who Albert Breer had ID'd in the lead-up to the draft as a guy who the media was lagging on. Basically, teams loved him, the media pundits were kind of not as in love, thought he was kind of a fringe guy, maybe second rounder, and Breer was just kind of like, everyone sees him as a top half of the first round type of guy. I love him. I actually didn't think we'd be talking about him in this show, but I am pleasantly surprised. Another Titan-centric question here. Best free agent addition, Trumaine Johnson to the Jets or Malcolm Butler to the Titans?
I like Trumaine Johnson to the Jets. I'm a big Trumaine Johnson fan. I believe the cornerback position, the biggest trait you can have, your job is to be a play stopper more than a playmaker. I like the guys that can force incompletions. If you can get interceptions, that's great, but give me the lanky physical stopper type, which is why I guess I would say if I were the Rams, I would have kept Tremaine Johnson over Marcus Peters, even though I think Peters is probably the better player. I want to build my stuff around Johnson. The difference, though, is Johnson costs a lot more in that discussion. Peters is still on his rookie deal. But to answer your question, I think Tremaine Johnson's a very good play stopper, and I like those kind of corners.
I'll just go Malcolm Butler then. So that
no,
we
that's
take the
courageous
other side of it.
Of you.
That is
very smart. By the way, Morris Claiborne played very well for the Jets last year. He quietly had the best season of his career. And so he wasn't what they thought he'd be coming out of LSU for the Cowboys, but he's turned into a quality starter. Now you have him opposite Tremaine Johnson, Buster Screen, if he's not getting penalties, he's a highly effective slot guy too. Not a bad, bless those young safeties with the Jets, Jamal Adams, Marcus May. It's not a bad secondary there in New York. They might have a pretty good defense this year.
I was going to say, it might be a really good defense there this year. We'll see how quickly it'll come together here. Last lightning round question before we get to the trivia answer. Biggest breakout at cornerback for 2018. Who are you going with?
My answer was, even before we started talking, was Adoree Jackson.
Okay. I'm going with Akello Witherspoon out in San Francisco. I'll throw the X factor of the Sherman mentorship in there with him, and I thought he was a guy who was going to take 2 or 3 years. He was I thought he was pleasantly good as a rookie.
I liked the second half of his season last year. He played very well. He read some – I think he had an interception. What was it, the Eagles game, I want to say? He had some nice plays on the ball. I remember that.
Are you ready for the trivia answer?
I am.
You were really close to right and then ended up being as wrong as you could be.
The that answer doesn't is, make any it, sense.
The well, you're about to hear why. You said it's Charles Woodson, 2009. He was still playing cornerback at that point. He is the only one since Deion in 94 to win it. But I was shocked that Darrell Revis, I shouldn't say shocked. I was surprised to see that Darrell Revis had never won a Defensive Player of the Year award.
That shocks me. That shows, by the way, and that shows the limitations of voters, to be perfectly honest with you, because Revis, we said Patrick Peterson doesn't get a lot of interceptions because he's a man-to-man corner, so he's not playing the ball, he's playing his man. That was true with Revis, and he played it so well that the ball never came near him anyway. So if you're Joe Blow voter or Pro Bowl voter, whatever you want to be at the end of the year, you're Defensive Player of the Year voter, you look at guys that have sacks, guys that have interceptions, fumble recovery, oh, that's pretty good. And Revis just doesn't stand out that way. So that's wrong that Darrell Revis never won a defensive player. He was the best defensive player in football for about the stretch from 09 to maybe 2011, 2012-ish.
Yeah, and it's, no one denies that cornerback is a premium position in the NFL, and that's what makes it even more surprising that Revis is the biggest prize, but essentially no one. Charles Woodson in the last 23 seasons is the only one to have won it. So,
and what did he have? What were his numbers that year? I bet he had a lot of interceptions and forced fumbles or glitzy stats.
He did. I will bring it up just to dot the I's and cross the T's at the end of the show here. He doubled up Revis in the voting. Although the way they do that is just everyone votes for a player. I don't. They still do it that way, don't they?
They do. You just get one vote for the guy. You don't rank your players or anything like that. They don't do it how we do it. They don't do AP poll style voting.
Yes, they should. 9 interceptions, 3 touchdowns, 4 forced fumbles. Yeah.
And to be fair to Woodson, those are enormous numbers.
Three touchdowns and 9 picks is impressive, no matter what you do.
That's 13 potential turnovers. I'm surprised. Charles Tillman wouldn't get Defensive Player of the Year votes, even though he used to do that as well, because Urlacher was always the head. Urlacher and Lance Briggs were always the headliners of those Bears defense.
Yeah. All right. That's a wrap for the show. Quarterbacks coming up next week. That will be the finale of the position ranking series, and then we have the mailbag show, so keep those questions coming. For now, thanks as always to producer Shelby Royston, all the guys at Cadence 13 who make us sound so good. Joe Rowles on the research this week. Sorry, Joe. I even double checked how to pronounce your name last time you helped us out.
Well, his Twitter handle is Joe Rowe, so he's cool
yes,
with Joe.
That's
Joe
throws,
Rowe. He's asking for it. In fact,
he is. Be smarter, Joe Rowles. But Joe Rowles making us sound smarter this week with the research help. But most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Like I said, very recently, actually, just send the mailbag questions. Talkback@themmqb.com, probably the easiest way. If you're on Twitter or Facebook, you should already know how to find us. Use that search function if you don't already follow us. And follow us as long as you're there. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. And of course, this show, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.